as you could probably tell from today's quiz, a lot of people got the first question on Tuesday's quiz wrong, which is unfortunate because there is a very important idea in that question. And most people, in fact, I think no one, expressed what that idea is. So I repeated the question in a different form on today's quiz, which I suppose you could argue is unfair since I haven't, actually I just forgot to do it again, I haven't posted the answers to Tuesday's quiz and we haven't talked about it yet. On the other hand, it is from your readings and there is a nice picture that illustrates what's going on in the text. If we have time at the end of today's lecture, I will talk about the answer to the quiz on Tuesday and then the extension to that for today's quiz, because it is important. You need to understand it, not only for implementing or not implementing swaps, but understanding how it is or what among the things that you have to do to write secure programs, the ability to control how people manipulate your objects as you pass them around is very important. And if you don't get that right, it's extremely difficult to figure out why not. And it's also very easy to subvert, too. So. But today we're going to start and end, for the most part, the discussion of the chapter you're supposed to read this week, which is chapter 3. We backtrack from 4 that we talked about last week. As the heading of the section for this week indicates, these are the basics, so I don't feel so bad about the fact that we are not going over the chapter 3 in detail. Again, you should be familiar with most of the stuff that's going on here. What I'd like to do today is talk about types, because it's important that you understand the ways in which Java manipulates types. Most of them are fairly straightforward, but it's going to be a base upon which we're going to build other things, in particular when we get to inheritance. So a good understanding of what's going on in Java. And there is one quirk, which is this distinction between objects and primitive types. This is a picture of the type system in Java. We start off with the set of all possible Java types, which immediately splits into two, the primitive versus reference split, which I just indicated. From there, the primitives split off into what you might expect, and then the references split off into a separate set of types. I'm not going to be talking about this until next week when we start talking about inheritance. Although, actually, we are going to be talking about strings and, I think, arrays today. But for the most part, we're going to be spending our time over here. We'll come back to this as we go along. We'll start off at the bottom with the simplest type, which is the Boolean type. A Boolean is essentially a one-bit value, as you might expect. It has literals, which are true and false. Unlike C and C++, the Booleans are a separate type. In other words, there's no immediate relationship between Booleans and integers. So if you're familiar with exploiting this property in C and C++, which is a certain amount of fun if you're that kind of person, can't do it here. Now we come to a vexing data type. This, again, is different from what it is in C++, and it's a lot less useful. In fact, characters, you can pretty much in Java forget about unless you're doing something really specific, which I think is a piece of information that Horseman gives. The characters in Java correspond to the wide character in C++. And they're 16-bit values, and they represent, oh, that's wrong. They represent something that's, well, we'll come to this too. They represent something that's known as a Unicode code point. They're actually closer, they correspond more closely to a code unit. But the correspondence between code points and code units for US ASCII, which is the character set that we use for the most part, is the same. So to a certain extent, this is correct. And I guess from one point of view, you could argue that saying code units is wrong, because it's true that they're code units, but the interpretation of them are as code points. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Character literals can be the characters themselves, as you might expect. Unicode character escapes, which is a hexadecimal, four-digit hexadecimal number, because you have 16 bits. And then you have the usual small set of letter escapes, backslash T, backslash N, backslash B, backslash whatever they are. Java characters are not convenient small integers. For example, in C or C++, if you need an 8-bit value, you can use a character and just treat that as an integer. Of course, you have to be a little careful because you have to determine whether or not it's assigned or unsigned, and that can bite you. But you don't have that problem in Java because you can't do that. They are essentially characters, and that's it. It's best to use them as characters and avoid using characters altogether, as Horstmann says. Part of the problem is this difference between Unicode code points and code units. The other problem is more or less the way in which characters relate to strings. So if you find yourself reaching for characters and using them a lot, you probably should stop and think about why you're doing that, because it's almost certainly the case, certainly in this class, you probably shouldn't be doing that. You're doing something wrong. You either have a misunderstanding of what your problem is, or you're misunderstanding the way you should be using characters. Certainly, if you have your, if you have a hard time, I used to, as I came from C++ and started writing Java, I would incur tremendous amounts of effort to do things that I would normally do very quickly in C++. And the problem was I was trying to beat characters in a way that they weren't meant to be beaten in Java. And I soon learned that if I find myself in that position, I need to stop and take a breath, figure out what I want to do, and do it properly. I recommend the same approach to you. If you find yourself spending a lot of time dealing with characters, you need to stop and ask, first of all, why am I doing it? Why am I dealing with characters? And secondly, all right, if I have to deal with characters, is this the right way to do it? And the answer is almost always, in the first case, no. And in the second case, also no. The exact number types represent n-bit 2's complement integers. We have four different sizes for those. We have the byte, which is 8-bit, short 16-bit, int 32-bit, long 64-bit. Much to my displeasure, there is no unsigned exact types.
Still work.
That's right. That's right, except... All right. I don't know if people can see that or not.
Yes.
Well... Well, let's see. The last time, what happened? The last time we had a power failure, something blew up and...
Substation.
Yeah, substation.
They were doing work on the power line.
Oh, was that what it was?
Like, no, today, like right on the way to school.
Oh, I see, I see.
Trees always fall down.
Yeah.
We only hear some traffic light that ripped off. It was like sitting on the side of the
road. Really? Does anybody know how windy it is out?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I heard
it's really windy.
And we're back. There are no unsigned types, which is annoying, because I like to use unsigned types. The literals are, as you might expect, pretty much, except for the size of the number of digits you put in the literal, the first three are indistinguishable, and then the fourth you have the uppercase L or lowercase L. This is actually not that important. When we get to doubles and floats, that will be. Oh, it's not working at all here. What's going on? Oh, wait a minute. Do I have to... Oh, this is running on RockHopper, and RockHopper went down probably, maybe. Well, what's going on here? Yeah. RockHopper's not up. Oh. Well, I have my notes. Back. back to the old ways. Exact number types. And then after exact, or the approximate. I should talk a lot about why these are approximate numbers. However, I'm not going to. These represent 32 or 64-bit floating point numbers. And these are, in fact, IEEE 574, I think it is. No, 754. IEEE 754 floating point numbers, which you would like to think means that they are standard, although it turns out that, and to a certain extent they are, but that doesn't really help you that much because it doesn't enhance portability, the kind of portability you'd like to get when everybody implements the same thing, or at least you'd expect to get when everybody implements the same thing. Which is one of the reasons I'm not going to talk about approximate numbers. I really don't like floating point numbers. That's why one of my definitions of a system programmer is somebody who never uses a floating point number. But we do have to talk about them because you will be using them when we get to graphics, because graphics uses floating point to represent coordinates and a lot of other things too. Floating point literals, the float, so there's two of those. Float, actually I should get the case right here, float and double. This is 32-bit, this is 64-bit. They have the usual syntax where you have some bunch of digits, a decimal point, some more digits, and then an optional exponent, and then some more digits, an optional exponent, optional sign, and then some more digits. Actually, probably. You use a F or an F to indicate 32-bit numbers, and you use a D or D to indicate, is that true? Yes, D or D to indicate a 64-bit number. If you're just looking at a floating point number, 2.34, that's double. So the default for floating point is double, as opposed to float, 64 versus 32. Because this is IEEE 754, you also have other things associated with floating point, such as positive and negative infinity, which is the kind of thing you get when you divide n by 0, for example. You also have something called NaN, which stands for not a number. You get not a number by doing essentially strange things. You under-normalize a number, and then you run it off the end of the mantissa, for example. That would end up with being not a number. That would be an over, I guess it depends on which direction you go. It could either be an overflow or an underflow. But anyway, the result is not a number. Not a number has a lot of strange properties associated with it. In fact, whenever anybody asks you a tricky question with respect to floating point in Java, they're almost always dealing with something having to do with positive and negative infinities and not a number, NaNs. For example, you can't compare NaNs. They're incomparable, so this is always false. Other strange things like that. We're not going to talk about floating points so much in this class, although we should. All right, now I say I have to draw a picture, so let me just see if Rockhopper's back. I will draw the picture. The picture I'm going to be drawing is the relationship among the primitive types. Those are all the primitive types we have in Java. There's the Boolean character, then the five or six, I guess, numeric representations. Byte, short, int, long, float, and double. Having introduced all those separately, we now have to figure out what the relationship among them is. This subscript represents the size in bits. So doubles are 64 bits, booleans are 1 bit. The arrow indicates subtype, the relationship between subtype and parent type. The tail of the arrow is the subtype, the head of the arrow is the parent type. So for example, this indicates that float is a subtype of double. Long is a subtype of float, int is a subtype of long, short is a subtype of int, byte is a subtype of short. Notice that character is a subtype of int, not of short. Boolean is not a subtype of anything. Like I said, it's off on its own. This relationship is transitive. That's almost certainly not how you spell transitive. In other words, you can conclude that long is also a subtype of double. However, it is a subtype in a different way, in the sense that there is presumably some conversion along the way in going from long, which is essentially has one representation, and double, which has a different representation. There's also the fact that we're losing a little bit of information here, which is something that will come. Well, boy, I hope it comes up. I got to draw a lot of pictures, so maybe I'll skip these two things and come back to them when Rockhopper shows up again. I believe that's all I want to say about this. For the most part, except for this separation of character and everything else, and the separation of Boolean, this is pretty much what you would expect to see from your C and C++ experience. Also, it's simpler because you don't have to worry about signed versus unsigned. I'm not going to draw that picture, but we do have to talk about it. So I will come back to that. One hopes eventually Rockhopper will show up again. So I'll come back to that picture. We have it essentially shows the conversions. This is the relationship that you can have using the subtype operation, and then you need to figure out what actually happens when, for example, you try and treat an integer as if it were a double. How do you do that, and what are the consequences of doing that? And I have a picture that shows you that, so I will just wait until I have the opportunity to show you that without having to draw it. And that's it for the primitive types. Any questions about that? I have another picture, which goes back to the original tree that we had of types. And I will not draw that again either. Actually, maybe I'll just reproduce a little bit of it. We had the Java types. And immediately underneath that, we had primitives and the reference types. Right. We're going to talk about the reference types now. The reference type in Java is similar to pointer to class type in C. So this is analogous to T star, where T is a class type. So from that point of view, you're more or less familiar with it. But there is actually one extremely important caveat. In fact, one could argue that this is the whole reason that you have Java. And what's that caveat? I've just drawn a relationship. I say, well, the reference types are like the pointer to class type in, of course, there is no such thing as a pointer to class type, but you can have a pointer to some type, and this type can be a class type. So that's what I mean, pointer to class type. So I said there's a relationship. This is essentially the relationship here, right? But not quite. There is one important difference, and the question is, what is that difference?
Yeah, null.
No. That there's a null in both. That's true. Generalize that. Well, what about pointer arithmetic?
Well, you can't, like, let's say you have T pointing to an array of ints, you can't say T plus plus and get to the next.
Okay, why can't I say that?
Because T in C plus plus or C, T is just a numeric value or a hexadecimal value.
No, I can say that. I can certainly, if I have this, let's make it concrete. Let's say, I guess you said array, didn't you? Right. I can do that, and I can certainly do this. That's perfectly okay.
In C++.
In C++.
But in Java, you can't.
In Java, you can't, right. My question is, why can't you?
Oh, isn't the reference just the space on the heap? Like, doesn't that point to the heap?
Yes, that's true, but that doesn't really say, why can't you do this in C++, or why can't you do this in Java? That's true, you're right, but that has nothing to do with the inability to do this. You want to take a stab or?
That's not primitive for me.
That's true. So what? That's true, but that's not, that doesn't answer the question about why you can't do it in Java. The reason you can't do it in Java is you do not have direct access to pointers in Java. That's the whole point behind reference types. It's the whole reason that Java, you could argue, it's the whole reason between Java and C++, the reason for the difference between the two is that you have addresses in Java, you have pointers in Java, but they are back there someplace where you can't get at them, you as the programmer. The only thing you can reference, the only thing you can touch is the reference type, which is a representation of the pointer. You can't actually get at the pointer itself, so you can't do pointer arithmetic, you can't do all that WYSIWYG stuff that you can do in C++. And that's an important characteristic. That's what lets you do garbage collection because pointers are now well-behaved. You don't have grubby little people doing all kinds of arbitrary arithmetic on pointers. So the reference type is analogous to the pointer to a class type in C++, except that you don't have access to it. You can't get directly at it. So any of the kind of things that you like to do in C++ by manipulating pointers, you're not going to be able to do in Java. The other point is roughly what, let's see, the other point is roughly what Jansen said. This has to be a, well, sort of. This has to be a class. Reference types in Java are always pointing to class instances. You can't have pointers to ints or booleans or anything like that. The split between the primitive types and the reference types is going to be a pain. It's more of a pain in the earlier versions of Java before Java 5. It's still a pain, but it's not quite as bad a pain for reasons that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. But it is there, and you have to keep it in mind. It echoes the difference between plain old data types, or called pods in C++, and the classes in C++. Pods being essentially the data types that were inherited from C, and classes being the things that were added to C and C++. All right, so now I have some pictures. Another difference between the reference type in Java and the pointer type in C++ is that the pointer type, you can, in a sense, use the pointer type to get directly to objects, object instances, class instances, because you can use the star operator. You dereference the star operator, and that gives you the thing itself. You don't have that in Java. Everything that you do to a class, you have to do through the pointers. So in that sense, you always have pointers to classes, class instances, whereas in C++, you could have the class instance itself. And I have a picture for that, so let's draw that. You should become, if you're not already, adept at drawing these kinds of pictures, because it will help you figure things out. So I have a variable B. It has a type blob. So that represents, again, because this is a class and not a primitive type, this represents a reference to a blob. So that is some small amount of storage, 32, well, I suppose it could be 16, but that seems kind of small. Certainly, well, it could be 16 on, for example, a environment that runs under a Java micro edition, like a handheld. You can only have, well, if it would be 16 bits, you can only have 64K approximately objects in your system. But normally this would be 32 or 64 bits in modern architectures. And then you would create a class instance of blob and set B to point to it. That's in contrast to primitive types, int I equals 1. Again, I would have a box. Here I know that this is a 32-bit box and it contains, using the 2's complement representation, 1. Similarly, for all the other primitive types, and I'm trying to think. My suspicion is if you allocate a Boolean, you will not get a 1-bit box. You will get an 8-bit box that is used to store the single value, true or false. I'm not exactly sure. I should probably look that up. But for all the other primitive types, there's some multiple of 8. So you're going to get some multiple of 8-byte values, 8-bit values. Furthermore, because of the JVM, this is always going to be true. No matter where you go, no matter on what you're running, you are going to have 64-bit doubles, 32-bit ints, and so forth. Again, that's specified by the JVM. That's the issue of portability that we talked about earlier.
Question.
Yes?
Is that word after reference values?
All accesses to Java classes are through. Yes. In fact, both of those words aren't really understandable. Are through reference values. Which actually leads to interesting problems when you are writing industrial strength software. You have to be able to efficiently manage huge numbers of these things. And if you're always going to and from the heap and invoking them through indirection, essentially, it's less efficient than you could do in C++. You could just allocate them directly, for example. Or you could have the usual trick there is you just have amortization, like we talked about in 305 last semester. If you want to allocate, I don't know, we may have talked about it in 306 too. If you want to allocate a linked list of 2-3 million entries, one of the things you can do is you can allocate a single block of storage that will hold 2 or 3 million linked list nodes. You do that once, okay, and then you can very quickly create a free list out of that and allocate to and from your block. That eliminates, essentially you make one system call to get the storage. You don't have that option in Java. You have to go to the storage allocator 2 or 3 million times. That's going to be a lot more expensive. And if you need to do that, then you need to manage that more efficiently than you would be able to do it in C++. Actually, I probably shouldn't have erased that. Oh, well. We'll come to the point that I've been raising for the past couple of minutes, the idea that we have two different kinds of types in Java. Two different kinds of types, the primitive types and the reference types. Again, that's very important. You need to internalize that. Much more so than you had to in C++, although you did actually have to do it in C++ in certain cases. The important point here is primitive types are not the same as reference types, and furthermore, they are incompatible. As I said, this was a real sticking point up before Java version 5. Let me illustrate. The question here is, will this method compile? The first question I guess I should ask is, why is this an interesting question? Why am I asking it? What's the sticking, or what do I believe to be the sticking point here? It's also a tricky question. If you know Java, this is a tricky question. I'll explain it in a couple of minutes why it's tricky, but what's the sticking point here? This is a method. No constructor where?
Aren't you making a new object?
I don't know. In that sense, you're right. I mean, the only thing that could be a sticking point is this statement. So what's this?
It's a primitive thing.
Right. A little bit more detail?
Integer.
You could say it's an integer, right? It could be a short, yeah. But it's fine. Type here?
Reference
type, right. So I'm saying reference type object type, reference type primitive. And I just told you that these are incompatible. And so the question, will this compile, should be no, because we have a type incompatibility here. This is a primitive type, and I'm trying to say it is somehow equivalent to this reference type. And I've just told you that they are not compatible. So the answer should be no. At this point, that answer is correct. In a couple of, did you have a question? Or?
Yeah, can you do that with strings though?
Can I do what with strings?
Like that sort of, like you can set strings equal to x whatever.
Oh, yes, yes. So what you're saying is, well, suppose I want an object that's 42, and how do I do that? You're right. It turns out you can do something even better, because it turns out the answer to this, the reason it's tricky, is the answer to this is yes, you can do it, for reasons that we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. But for now, we'll accept the answer no. Oh, you know, I forgot to do attendance. Oh, well, that's life. Maybe we'll do it at the end. Where am I? Okay. But for now, we will take the answer no. On the other hand, this is not an unreasonable thing to want. As I said, I want to have an object that represents the integer 42. How can I get one of those things? And I'm going to be sloppy, particularly since I have to write things down. And I'm going to probably say things like reference, when I should actually be saying reference type. I will try and say reference type, but you will forgive me if I slip. What we need is we need some kind of conversion. Because of the incompatibility, there's no automatic conversion. Unlike, for example, going from an int to a long, which automatically converts. I need some conversion, some specific conversion that will go from primitive types to reference types. With respect to numbers, there is the, what is it, Java numeric, I believe, no. There's the Java lang number. If you remember the picture I had put up, the tree of the taxonomy there, I had numeric at one point. That represents the Java lang number children. You have essentially under the number children, you have a class per primitive type, following the usual rules of class naming. So you have integer corresponding to int, double corresponding to double, and so forth and so on. This is approximately the same thing that Jordan mentioned about going from strings to, well, we won't talk about what Jordan mentioned because we shouldn't do it, because you can do it better this way. But you can also do it that way, particularly if you're reading in, for example, from the console or from a stream. Then you're pretty, since the only thing you have is a string. But separate from that, you should go this way.
Does that mean that when you create a primitive type, you're actually creating an object?
No, it's a primitive type. You have to explicitly convert, which you do using these. And of course, as you might expect, you use the constructors to do that. So let's see, I believe an example here. The way we should appropriately write the method I just erased is, so you create a new integer reference type with the initial value 42. This is actually, I believe, an immutable type, which means that once you give it a value, you can't change that value. This is now a reference type, so I can assign it through alchemy that we will start talking about next week to a variable whose type is reference type. We actually need to put, yes, sorry.
Does that mean that object is a subclass of integer or?
Backwards. Backwards. You've got it backwards. That would mean that integer is a subclass of object. This procedure of taking a primitive type and stuffing it into the associated reference types is known as wrapping the primitive type. You also have the corresponding unwrapping operation, which is extracting the underlying primitive type, which I believe is called value of. No, it's not. It's called, I guess in the case of integers anyway, it's called int value. So you can wrap a primitive type using the constructor, and then you can unwrap the embedded primitive value using the associated int, or I suppose t value method. Short value, double value, float value. I have an example here. Do I want to take the time to write it out? Well, I may as well, just to illustrate. No, no, because underlying, as you might expect, this is a really simple implementation. Yeah. Certainly one of the instance methods in this class is an integer to hold a value. Mm-hmm. So you don't lose any information there. If you want to do any conversions, you would have to do them in the parameter. So for example, if I wanted to store 3.141592 blah, 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 as an integer, I would have to first explicitly convert that, because at this point I'm going to lose information. I essentially have to throw away the fractional part. Generally speaking, this is not always the case, generally speaking, Java does not let you do this. You have to explicitly throw away information. So in this case, we would have to explicitly downcast this to an integer and then go. If I just didn't have this, I would get a type error.
Okay.
Is that a question? It means that you can't change the instance. So in this, let me do this. So integer I is equal to 3, essentially. What I can't do is this, because that would essentially try to change the value of I to the next larger value stored there. I can do anything that does not try and change I. So I can do this. I can't do this. Well, actually, you can. No, I can't do this. I cannot do this, because this essentially what this is saying is take I, add 7 to it, and then, well, you see, now here's the problem. Well, let's draw a picture. I said you should become facile at drawing these pictures. So let's stop and take a look at this. I should point out that, in fact, you can't do any of these for reasons that I will talk about when we're done. However, you can do things like this, and I will tell you why you can't. But it's easier just to write things like this as opposed to writing them appropriately. So let's just assume that you can do this, and I'll tell you why you can't do this in a minute. We're doing this operation. First of all, does everybody understand what this does? What does this operation do? Right. So it's essentially equivalent to Matt's question is, can I do this? What's the answer? Well, first of all, why is that a question? I mean, why would you have doubts about your ability to do this?
Well, because J is pointing to an object.
This is an I.
Or I is pointing to an object that has a value of 3.
Okay.
And if you were going to do that, and it's immutable, that means that it would be the same situation that you have for string, where you need to create a new object and point to that.
Right, so there's this issue of immutability. So let's draw the picture. Show me the picture here, where at this point in execution, what picture do I draw? Somebody like, draw the picture for me. Of this state here, right here, just before we execute. The picture I drew. Right.
7 is added to it?
Right.
Can it just be I then?
Well, draw it.
So, just draw an I?
Well, draw the picture that I had drawn on the board earlier.
Which one was that?
The boxes picture?
I don't remember which one it was. But I think I have
another one. Oh, look over the chalk. I'll start you off.
Oh, without the, okay. So, it'd just be... That'd just be it.
And what else is... What's in the box? What type is I?
An integer? A primitive? I don't know. It's an integer, right?
No, what's this type? It starts with a capital letter, so it's a...
Oh, is it a class?
It's a class, so this is a reference type.
Okay.
So what's in here? Okay. Okay. That's fine. You don't have to. You don't. Well, maybe you should. I don't know. Right. Okay. And what's inside the integer class? Just. Among the things that are inside the integer class, what's the important thing inside it?
Oh, probably this.
Okay. Which is a, at this point,
the,
is it?
Yeah, no, I guess like a...
There, okay, that's fine. Somewhere, presumably, one of the instance variables in this instance is something called, for example, var, or value. And it, too, is a box, 32-bit box that contains 3. So that's the state of the world before we execute. See, at this point we've run out of knowledge. I haven't really told you what this actually means. I sort of indicated down here by saying that we actually can't do this. That it doesn't mean what you think it means. But let's just throw the chalk and see what he does with it. So you want to... Let's see, what do you want to draw? You want to draw... I don't know, what do you want to draw? So draw this part before it actually gets executed. Before we actually do the addition.
So you still have that?
Still have that.
Okay. So I'm thinking that you would have a new reference to...
All right, that's too far. Just, okay. You were right the first time.
7.
All right.
And then another one?
Okay, no, that's good. That's fine. Just give this a name, like T for temp.
And then...
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
If we're going to do the addition, we need to add 2 things. We already have I... So we need to get the other operand, addand, I guess they call it, which would be 7. Here's the tricky part. You can't add a primitive to a class instance. So what you need to do, that, and that's one of the reasons why this is not a correct statement, is because this is a type error. You can't add a primitive to an instance of int, integer. So in fact, what you would have to do is turn this into an integer instance, which is what Matt has just done. Now we have 2 instances of integers, I and this constant here, which I've called T, or Matt has called T. All right, so that's just before we've done the addition. And now we'll draw what happens after we do the addition.
So basically, we're adding the values that are pointed to or referred to by these.
Exactly. So what would the result of that be?
We would have I.
And this is actually the other thing we didn't talk about, so this is why this is tricky.
It points to this value, 3.
Okay. Well, you don't. If it doesn't change, you don't have to repeat it. It's just...
But it... does change because you're adding 7 to it.
Well, now we come to the heart of the original question, right? What was the original question? Was it Matt's question? What was the original question?
Do you create a new object with a 10 in it and then have to destroy the first two?
Okay, and why did you ask that question? What was the...
It was immutable.
Right. We have these things, these instances are immutable. You cannot change them.
So this cannot become 10.
Exactly. Well, no, that's right. This cannot become 10. So you have to do something else. You have to show me the result. You have to do something else to show me the result after the addition has been carried through.
So you would have to create a new object.
There you go.
Points to 10.
Exactly, there you are.
But I feel like I missed a step in there.
Oh, we missed...
Because at what point are you actually combining the two values? And I know that sounds like a very basic question, but you are referencing these two values.
Right.
At what point are you actually making them 10?
Okay, all right. Well, for now, we can just say when you do the addition.
Mm-hmm.
But I will show you how you should actually write this when we're done. As soon as... Now, what is Jordan going to draw here? Well, we can certainly tell Jordan to draw something, but then Jansen would be out in the cold.
Would it just be the assignment?
Yeah, so why don't you get up there and draw the assignment for us? No, that's wrong. Yes, that'll do. That'll do. Sorry, my mistake. Okay. Does this answer your question now? The point here is, even though the instance is immutable, right, this declaration is mutable. So I can change the reference to the thing I point. I cannot change the thing I point. I cannot change the thing to which I am pointing, but I can change the pointer itself. So that's an important distinction. And you also have this in C++, right? This is the whole deal with const. I don't know, does anybody use const when they program in C++? I use it all the time. And if you use this with respect to pointers, you understand that there's something funny going on. Well, you have a similar thing in Java, except the keyword is not called const, it's called final. If this declaration was final integer I, right, then this would be, I couldn't do this, because this would then become immutable. But the important point here is if we get rid of this and leave it just like this, the variable I itself is not immutable. I can point it off to any instance of an integer that I want. The thing that I cannot change is the integer value itself.
Right. So what happens when you're no longer pointing to that value? It gets rid of?
Okay, yes, it gets garbage collected. So essentially what happens is, I guess the way you could have drawn it is like this. You could say, all right, like that. Right, now this is floating off in space and will eventually be garbage collected. Okay. Why can't you do this? I said that you couldn't do this. And there's two reasons why you can't do it. That's the first one. What did I say, 7? Well, it doesn't matter. If this is a reference to an integer instance, then I plus 1 is wrong for two reasons. The first reason is The plus operator is not defined for integer. I actually don't know what the name of the method is, but it's presumably something like add or addition or plus or something like that. Integer.add is defined. So this would have to be, first of all, and you should have seen an example of this when I sent around that factorial, because the factorial used big int, which has the same properties as integer, except that they have essentially infinite precision, infinite size. So that's the first reason you can't do this. The second reason? A little tricky, but...
The value of I is immutable.
That's true, but I'm not... Oh, I didn't tell you what the return type of this is. It returns a new instance of integer that represents the sum of this and this. So this will return the value of I plus the value of 1, whatever that might be, as a new instance of an integer.
Isn't that only temporary?
Yes, but presumably what you would do is something like this. I equals?
Because wouldn't you have to actually create the address instead of just kind of like shoving, giving it a value?
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding your question.
Like, that's not really returning a reference, is it? J.add 1?
Yes. How would you, let's come back to that. Let me just finish this out. What's the second thing that's wrong with this is add is not defined on, again, what's the type of this argument?
Primitive.
It's a primitive, and add is not defined on primitives. It's defined on other integers. So I would actually have to say I dot add new integer 1. Or, again, I'm not sure, we'll have to check this, but my suspicion is it would be there. We would have a static class instance called 1. So we could do this instead. And in this case, what we would have to do then to legitimize the thing that I just erased, we would have to say that I is equal to I dot, what was I doing? I guess I was adding. Well, essentially it would be this replaced with 7. All right, so this is what our assignment would look like that we were drawing over there if we wanted to do it syntactically and semantically correct. Okay? So that's why these aren't legitimate. You would have to replace this with I dot multiply new integer 3, so forth. All right? Pain. And the reason you can't do this is, as Jansen pointed out, you can't overload operators. You can't overload methods. You can have several methods called add, as long as you can distinguish them. You cannot overload operators as you can in C++. All right, questions about that? Again, I've gone through this in detail because it's important. You need to understand what's going on. Actually, as it turns out, you don't, for reasons that we'll talk about in a minute. But let me get back to Jansen's question. So, what was your remind us what the question was? Let me just put that back up again. So you had this was the. Did we have the integer? Yeah, I guess, did we? Yeah, we must have. All right, and what was your question?
Because when I looked at it, it kind of looked like he was returning something that...
Yes, it is.
Was it a reference class?
It is. So if we looked at the signature for the add, it would be integer add integer. So it accepts an integer, and it returns an integer. Okay. So does that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's push it a little further then. How would you implement this? How would you implement this ad? Yes, you could do that. Integer s equals.
New integer. Actually, is there? You probably have to call the get value for the two before you did that, right?
Well, remember where we are. We're inside the integer class. Although you're right, you could, but we can cut that short a little bit. Well, why don't you just go ahead and tell me what to do, and we'll come back and clean it up.
Yeah, I was saying call j dot, or whatever you brought in, I dot get value plus this dot get value.
Exactly. And then?
Return s.
So if we draw a picture, here is I. And this has some value v1. I'm sorry, I should be probably a little bit more. Here's this. It has some value v1. Here's the parameter. It has some value v2. Inside the add, the only thing I need to do is create the return value, which will contain v1 plus v2. Notice that this preserves immutability. I'm not changing anything. I'm creating a new thing that contains the value as the sum of the previous two things. So that's how we preserve immutability. So this is how you'd implement it in a way that preserves immutability. Questions about that? This is actually a matter of reasonable importance. So it is good that we took the time to go over it. Any questions? Now we can talk about why we're never going to do any of this stuff. Having to wrap and unwrap, although I haven't actually given you any examples of unwrapping, having to wrap and unwrap primitive values is a real pain, having to stick those things in. You can see, you can get some idea of how cumbersome it actually is. And as I said, up until Java 5, you had to do it because there was no automatic conversion between primitives and the wrapped versions of those primitives. In Java 5, they added something that's known as auto-wrapping, which is an automatic conversion from the primitive to the associated wrapper class. So in fact, that initial example that I used to start this whole thing off with is legal, will compile. I said that was the tricky part. The reason it will compile is because auto-wrapping will essentially translate this. In other words, the compiler will see this and say, oh, that's a primitive. It is a wrappable primitive. Well, all the primitives are wrappable. So I can just change this into... This was a great boon to writing Java code. Writing Java code before Java 5 was a real pain in the neck. You know, I said writing Java code is no fun. It was absolutely no fun before Java 5 because you had to insert all of this stuff all over the place. Similarly, in the other direction, if you wanted to, I don't know. Well, the example I have in the notes involves hash tables. If you want to hash on integers, the problem with hash tables are that it requires an object for the key, which means that if you want to hash on integers, then you have to wrap the integers. But that's not a problem because you can just rely on auto-wrapping to take care of that for you. On the other hand, if you want to look at a key that's associated with a particular object, you get an int object when you actually want the integer. Well, we know how to do that. You call int value. But again, that's a pain. Auto-unwrapping will essentially insert that int value call automatically for you. So that's an example of unwrapping. For the most part, auto-wrapping and auto-unwrapping allow you to forget the fact that primitives and reference types are different and incompatible. it does a pretty good job of papering that over, so you don't have to think about it. On the other hand, when we get to generics, the difference is going to come back again, which is one of the reasons I don't particularly like generics. But for now, you can essentially just rely on the fact that another term for wrapping and unwrapping things automatically is known as auto-boxing, or usually just boxing. So boxing and unboxing, because you can think of, as we drew in these pictures, you can think of a integer instance as a integer, an int in a box. Right? So when you box it, you put the int in the box, and when you unbox it, you take the int out of the box. So auto-boxing, or just boxing and unboxing. Oh, you know, we haven't talked about the assignment either. Almost eliminates the difference. I want to say it completely eliminates the difference, but for some reason there's a voice in the back of my head saying, no, that's not right. But I can't think about why it would be. I've already indicated when we get to generics, we're going to have to reestablish that difference. But if we don't deal with generics, I want to be able to say then you can just forget it, but I don't think that's correct, and I don't know why it wouldn't be. But rather than take time, let's just go on. So what's next? Boxing example, okay. Are there any questions about that? Even though it is taken care of for you by the compiler, it's important that you understand what's going on, because as you might expect, there's some efficiency issues in here. And for some reason, at least the stock editions of the JVM don't do any optimizations. Or actually, maybe that's not true anymore. Let me not say that, because I'm not sure that it used to be the case that they didn't do anything with respect to these operations, but it may in fact be the case now that they optimize things. It had something to do with backwards compatibility, or I'm not exactly sure, but let me not say that. Next up is arrays, but I don't know that we're going to have enough time to go through the whole thing. Let me stop at this point and go on to the assignment. So your first assignment is out. Do I have a copy of it? No. That's all right. I will just try and remember. Does anybody have any questions about the first assignment?
Just have on the games that you listed that we could implement, some of them are in some of them are blacked out, kind of like you can't do it. But was that just residual from another class?
Yes. I struggled mightily with. Usually, I hate to repeat things, because it's like, oh, we can learn something new. And I wanted to do something new here, but then on the other hand, I thought I could still have some fun with the solitaire. I had the last year's class do this too, play solitaire, or implement a solitaire game. And I was torn between doing something else and doing solitaire again. And for some reason, I decided, well, since I usually just go on and do a new thing, I decided to try and do an old thing again. So yes, the things that you can't do were the games that were done last semester. Although a couple of people actually have picked games already, so those, of course, will be done this semester.
But the ones done last semester we can redo?
No, you can't. I don't know why I did that. Probably because they were already checked off, so I figured I'm not going to go in there and fix that. So, you know, it's lazy. That's what it is, essentially. I mean, if you really, well, no. Because the other thing, of course, the other thing that the class did for me, that other class did, and they're very good at this, I will say that, is they pre-screened all the easy ones. Right? So Free Cell was gone immediately. Golf was gone immediately. So my assumption is those are all the really easy ones. So that's probably the other thing that. So even if your heart's set on doing Free Cell, you're just going to have to.
The only game I
well, now you get to learn a new game. Sorry, Matt.
Getting past and what, like, I'm not clear of what the interface is going
to
be.
That's up to you to decide. I will put, as soon as everybody picks a game, I will pick a game too, and then I'll put an example up of what your interface should look like. Or maybe I'll just put the one I did last year up. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Okay, so
actually, I'd like to take another crack at it, but
so we're basically going to name our methods similar to, or basically the same as what you're posting. I'm wondering how it's going to be run. You know what I mean? Like, because it seemed like you just wanted one method that was, I forget what it was called, but it seemed like that was kind of like the driver program.
I'll put up an example, but no. Your game should act as the referee. You can do one method if you want, but that I don't think is going to work very well.
Right, but where are you getting the... Like, in other words, your game is the referee, so that means that you're getting instructions or something from another...
No, the... Well, what do you mean by instructions?
Like, is your test program going to be saying... deal new hand.
Yes, it will.
So it's going to be calling our whatever methods.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And so your test program will say like move this here or whatever, and if that's not illegal move, we shut down or throw an arrow.
We can talk about that. You can certainly do that. My preference is with respect to that question. On the one hand, it seems kind of crude to just die.
Right.
On the other hand, if the player doesn't work, which clearly is the case because they made a bad move, then what else are you going to do? So you can do it either way. I did not, again, because things that just die aren't very well or aren't very good. But that certainly is one thing you can do. So I actually pass back error values, saying, well, it's not my concern. I will just point out that this is an incorrect move and point out why it's an incorrect move and let them deal with it. Now, if they want to blow up, that's fine.
Right.
But I won't blow up. If you want, you can blow up. That's not a particularly good solution to the problem, but there is some small justification for doing that. Eventually, what will happen here is that you'll be implementing, as I showed you in my example, you'll be implementing a front end for this, a graphical front end.
Okay.
So, blowing up in the back in the back end is not really cool.
So for now, it's okay to assume that we're going to be inputting and outputting as though there were a user sitting there pounding on this thing. Like,
right. That's important, right. Although, keep in mind that the user doesn't have to be a human being.
Right.
We're going to write these methods. What should these methods expect?
That's up to you. That's for you to determine.
But I don't understand what input.
What did you pick a game?
Yes.
Was it 13?
Yes.
Okay. So I don't know how to play 13. Well, let's all right. Well, that was stupid then, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Let's pick a game like I don't know. Well, we could play Eagle's Wing. Oh, we can't play Eagle's Wing because Rock Hopper isn't up. I don't have a copy of it here. So what's another?
I only know the regular solitaire. Of course, it was dead.
Bad Freestyle.
Calculus 2.
I know the game 13.
Oh, okay.
It's easy where you have a pile of 10 cards and you basically take cards off the piles that add up to 13.
Okay, well, one way to think about it is now this is an exercise in object-oriented design. So you've just told me one of the things that your interface has to support. We could just do the obvious thing. All right, you're going to have to support the concept of a pile. And, in fact, you're going to have to support the concept of 10 piles.
Right.
So that's one thing that your interface is going to have to support. The question is, how do you do that? And that's up to you.
I guess it's what the method is actually doing on how it knows how many piles and cards and matching and stuff like that. That's, I guess I'm wondering, do our methods really expect anything in or expect anything out? That's what I'm not understanding.
We're just going to print the board and it'll say.
No, you're not going to, it's a back end.
Right, that's what I was. As far as the back end, what's going to be interacting with it, you know what I mean?
Like, if we have to check to see if the application, if the game is even running, don't we need to know the name of the application?
No, because what you would have in your interface, well, again, it's up to you, but it's certainly one obvious way to approach this. Yes, we're going to be going over them not next week, which is inheritance, but the week after, which is interfaces.
Which only leaves us a week to understand them and get the assignment done. You know, there's something called an interface. It's a type of class, I think.
Yes.
I try to understand it.
All right, well, let's not worry about whether it's impossible even to do the assignment. Let's just worry about, assuming it is possible to do it, how might you do it? So certainly one method you would have in your interface is start game.
Right.
That tells you when the game starts. You as the back end. So if we draw a picture, this is what you're writing, the back end. And then there's another thing out here, which we'll call the front end. Right, this is the player. And then this is, if you want, the referee.
But if I'm checking to see if the game has started or not in this start game method, should I expect some kind of input?
Well, that's up to you. If you want to have input, I don't know what kind of input you would want to expect, but if you think that there should be input, then you'll put parameters here. And the front end will then call start game with whatever parameters you think it should provide. Or if you don't think it needs any parameters, then you won't specify any. The return value, similarly, is up to you to decide. Okay.
And your interface should also have stuff like remove card or add card.
Yeah, right.
And then if they call that method, if your test program calls that method at an inappropriate time, then we're just expected to say, hey, this is, you know, either throw an error message or do handle that.
Right.
So you're
you are expected to detect it.
Right.
And do something with it.
So your whatever your test program or actually, which is called the one method, start game, and see, this is where I'm like maybe not understanding a little bit, because I'm thinking start game would say, would print out to the screen like here are your options.
No, start game, this is the back end.
So we're just expected to create in memory the deck and the positions and the piles.
Exactly.
And then the front end is going to
do the printing or do anything. But again, generally speaking, back end should be silent. They don't produce any output other than what you're supposed to produce through the method calls.
So these method calls are basically just checking. They're not really creating anything.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, start game would create the game.
But then how do you know what application to call?
How does all right, you're gonna have to put some
how do you know
who's you?
What are you calling in the method to start?
Who's you?
In this method, start game.
Right.
Within there, if you're actually starting an application.
No, you're not. You're starting a game. You're starting a game of 13. This whole thing, if you want to think of it that way, is the application. This is a piece of the application.
Then I don't understand what we're supposed to be doing with this assignment, because this just seems, I don't feel like we've gotten enough information in order to create in 3 weeks, because we haven't learned about things like instances until the week before the assignment is due.
Interfaces.
The interface, I'm sorry. I'm really confused as to what these methods are supposed to be doing if we don't have any game code are we also supposed to be creating this game pool?
Yes.
To start up for assignment one?
Yes. And you're also supposed to be documenting the, because that's the other part. There's two parts to this. There's the documentation, and then there's the actual game itself. I think, is that right? That's right, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Are there any other questions? All right, that's it. We're out of time. So I'll see you next week.